WLFP Braddock.
Good morning, locals. Good afternoon, overseas listeners. Good morning to Peter.
Good morning.
Yes, and hello, Nancy.
Hello, you can say good afternoon to me.
Oh, are you? Where are you?
I'm in Maine.
Oh, okay.
Enjoying a beautiful June afternoon.
Great. Nancy Harmon Jenkins, I mean, you're probably one of the best known writers and food experts in the Mediterranean genre, don't you think?
Oh, I can't answer that question.
Well, I will.
You're asking me to be too immodest.
Listen, somebody, I think Carrie Bachman said to me, can we get Nancy on the show? And I said, I love her work.
I'm so glad to hear that. I love writing it, I have to tell you.
Well, you have a good subject.
Yes, it is. It's a great subject. And, of course, it requires me to spend a lot of time in the Mediterranean.
Oh, that's tough. That's really tough, I know.
Yeah.
Now, your latest book is called Cucina del Sole.
That's right, and you pronounced it correctly, too, which is wonderful.
Well,
so many people call it Cucina del Sol, and I say, it's not really about soul food.
Oh, no. But it is, in a way, isn't it?
Yes, it is, indeed. You're absolutely right.
And more than a little bit Italian. And from the Messaggiano also.
Yeah, I was raised in Sicilian cooking.
Oh, you were? Oh, yeah. Lucky you.
Oh,
gosh.
Yes. But and I always have this question. I once had a lot of fun with Lydia Bastianich. When she did her book, Italian-American Cuisine.
Oh, yeah.
I told her what my Italian-American family cooked, and she told me what the real ingredients were that should have been there from the old country. And that was a great game. That was fun. But I always want to know, have you ever heard of a Swiss chard stuffed bread called scotcha?
Well, I've heard of a Swiss chard and cheese stuffed double-crusted pie, but not of a bread itself.
Yeah, this is Italian bread. And then the other one is a strange pasta that was common in my family called pasta Indiana, which was pasta topped with sautéed onions, fennel fronds, mind you, and cauliflower.
But you had a particular reason for writing this book, Nancy, so why don't you explain it?
Well, it's just that I think that the south of Italy is one of the most exciting parts of the entire country, and to me, it's a region that Americans don't know very well, even though most of us who have an Italian background come somehow from the south, you know, from Naples or from Puglia or from Sicily. And yet, the only way we know that cuisine is through Italian-American food. And Italian-American food is wonderful. But when you get back to the real thing, to the home country, then you get into those deep southern flavors that are just so exciting.
And there, some of them are really unusual. I mean, speaking from the Sicilian side, the Arab influence was so incredible.
Yeah, the Arab influence, but also the Spanish influence. I think sometimes we forget about that. I think a lot of what we like to call the Arab influence actually came from Spain.
That's what you said. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
You think it came from the Arabs to Spain via the Moors and then to southern Italy via the Spaniards.
Yeah, because the Spanish really ruled southern Italy for a long, long time, and we forget about that.
Well, and then the whole Greek thing. I remember a friend of mine brought her fiancé, who happened to be Greek, to our house when we lived in D.C., and I made lemon oregano chicken.
Uh-huh.
And he said, thank you for making Greek chicken. And I said, it's not Greek chicken.
Well, it's true. I mean, I think that Greek, that's one of the reasons why I chose the regions that I did of that part. Because, you know, the South, really, most people think the South begins at Rome. And in a sense, it does. And the Abruzzi is part of the South. And even Sardinia is part of the South. But I wanted to focus on that region that the Greeks called Magna Graecia, Great Greece, because it was so important in the ancient world. You know, Campania, Calabria, Basilicata, Puglia, and Sicily. These were the five regions that had a really heavy Greek influence on them. And that influence lasted up until the time the Romans came along and kicked the Greeks out, and then the Greeks came back under the Byzantine rule. And so for centuries, for generations, people were getting their culinary influences from Greece and vice versa.
Yeah,
so
you mentioned
it was really important. That sense, you know, the importance of olive oil, the importance of fresh vegetables, the importance of seafood, all of that is something that you sense in Greece as well, if you've ever been there.
Yes. I like the bit you wrote about true Southern cooks will use only extra virgin olive oil for everything.
Yeah, that's true.
And
I think I haven't been able to figure out, I've asked many people this, I haven't been able to figure out when refined olive oil was invented, but I think it might have been in the 1930s.
Really?
And it was a way of turning, sort of rot-gut olive oil that nobody wanted into something that was acceptable for people to use. But extra virgin olive oil is really what everybody uses there, and it's what we ought to be using, too, here.
Yeah, I was curious when you mentioned that for a long time, people in Sicily and the Magna Graecia anyhow spoke Greek, right?
Yeah, they did, indeed.
Does that translate to it's getting rarer, the Sicilian accent, but the first trip I ever made to Sicily, I couldn't understand it because I had studied Toscana.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
And now I don't find that trouble at all because you hardly ever encounter anybody speaking Sicilian dialect.
Well, but, you know, I went, I do these tours to Sicily with the CIA, with the Culinary Institute of America. And the first time I did one, we didn't have quite enough people signed up for it. So the travel agent had her cousin come along. And her cousin grew up in a household where the mother and the father, they were much older, and they had come straight to America from Sicily, and she grew up speaking a Sicilian dialect, and the Sicilians nearly killed themselves laughing when they heard her talking because it was a dialect that they hadn't heard in decades.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you should. My husband's from Yorkshire, and a broad Yorkshire accent isn't even English, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, so it's even harder to understand than a Sicilian accent, I think.
Well, I don't know about that. It depends whether you start out speaking English or whether you start out speaking Italian. I think.
Right.
Now, how did you organize this book, Nancy?
Well, you know, it was a question. The first time I started talking about it, I have a friend in New York who's kind of my guru as far as cookbooks are concerned. He has a wonderful bookshop in New York called Kitchen Arts and Letters.
Oh, I love that place.
Yeah, it's a fabulous bookshop. Anyway, I went in to talk with Nock Waxman, the owner of the place, which I always do. And he said, well, I hope you will divide it up by the regions and you'll tell what each region, what distinguishes one region from another.
But you didn't do that.
And I thought, well, that's a very good idea. And I really thought about doing it that way. But you know what? In the end, I discovered that these regional boundaries are modern political boundaries that don't have anything to do with the real culture of people. So rather than dividing it up according to regions, I just divided it up in the conventional cookbook way, but describing each recipe and telling where it came from. And many of the recipes are things that you'll find all over the South. But others are very specific. You'll only find cicciri e tria in Puglia, for instance.
Right.
And you'll only find pasta con le sarde in Sicily.
Right.
And, you know, others, pizza napoletana, obviously, you'll only find in Naples.
Right. You know, Puglia is becoming trendy. People.
Oh, you know, I think it's very trendy. You know, I'm really angry with not the publisher of this book. I love the publisher of this book. I did a book about Puglia called Flavors of Puglia. It's a wonderful book. I think it's the only book.
You know,
I tried
to get that. You wrote that, was it 2 years ago?
No, it was a long time ago. It's out of print. Good luck getting it.
Oh, then I didn't get it.
I saw on eBay they're selling it for $120 a copy.
Oh, no.
But I do have copies of it, as it turns out. Because an Italian publisher republished it in English, and they sent me 200 copies. So if you really want a copy, I'll send you a copy of it.
Well, I thought but it was not as crowded as it is now. When did we go to Puglia?
We went in 2000.
2000, yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean,
I think it's
wonderful. You
as
know,
long
it reminds
as you stay away from those white things.
Italy, the way Italy was when I first went there. The whole country was like that. It was a different place from here.
Yeah, I mean, agriculture. I've never seen so many garlic.
Oh, garlic and artichokes.
Oh, yeah.
And green peas and fava beans. My gosh, it's just amazing.
Two of the most unusual things in Puglia, from my experience, not being much more innocent of Italy than the two of you are, is, first of all, Puglia was the first place we saw large quantities of horse meat on sale.
Because
the butchers divided themselves up between the cavallos and the vacas. But the other thing was our first meal in Puglia. We went out to a restaurant in Barletta. mm-hmm. called a vecchia, something or other. And we sat down at a long table that looked like it was for about eight people. And then food just started to arrive.
Uh-huh.
And by the time 5 minutes had passed, there were 12 dishes on the table. Uh-huh. And there was no room for anybody else to sit down. But I believe, I understand that this is, in fact, a Puglian tradition, that they do this, you know, at least 10 or 12 antipasti without you even ask for them.
Well, that's it. That's something that comes straight out of the Eastern Mediterranean, I think. You know, the idea of the meze begins a meal where
that's
you have
true.
10 or 12 dishes, and you're only expected to eat a tiny, just a taste of each one. And then that's all taken away, and if you've got any room left, you'll have your primo and then your segundo.
Right.
But I've seen that also in Calabria. And I think it's pretty typical of the South in general. But Puglia is really known for the variety of the antipasti that they put out.
Yeah, well, we came to that conclusion because it happened other places as well.
Mm-hmm.
Did you
eat raw seafood when you were in Puglia?
Well, that was the next course.
Oh, that's funny.
It was so funny because the owner asked us then, after having had the antipasti, did we eat crudo?
Mm.
And we said, of course we did.
Yeah.
So indeed, you're absolutely right. The next course was all raw seafood.
Yeah.
And then this Italian who was eating in the restaurant said to me that he would never
eat anything like that. Well, we met that funny Japanese lady too.
Yeah,
and she ate everything we ate except the crudo.
Oh, how interesting!
Could you hold on while we take a break for ads?
Yeah.
Thanks, Nancy. We'll take a break.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom Rita, the networking guy and host of Pittsburgh's most unique business show, Business in the Fast Lane. We're on every Saturday morning from 12 noon to 1 p.m. right here on The Edge, 1550 a.m. For the past 24 months, we've been bringing the best and the brightest into our studios to offer you ideas, advice, and real-world examples to help you grow your business. So save those honeydews for the afternoon and join me, Tom Rita, every Saturday morning from 12 to 1 on The Edge for Business in the Fast Lane, Pittsburgh's best kept secret.
Teach your child the responsible use of online resources. Tell them up front what your rules are for internet use and the consequences of breaking them. Take some time to explore valuable uses of the internet with your child. This safety tip brought to you by Pennsylvania Learners Online Cyber School. For more information on how your child can attend classes from home at no cost to you, visit www.palearnersonline.net or call the Allegheny Intermediate Unit at 412-394-5700.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Ferguson, and I'm the owner of Suzanne Ferguson & Associates. I'm the coach that helps you get what you say you want. Are you getting what you want out of your business? Do you and your staff always reach your goals? At the end of each day, each quarter, each year, are you totally satisfied with your productivity and profitability? I'm a professional coach, and my business is completely dedicated to helping my clients make changes within their lives and business that result in increased productivity and profitability. None of us has 20/20 vision on ourselves. My clients tell me that what makes my approach unique is that I bring a fresh perspective that allows their new ideas and actions to come forth. What kinds of changes do you want to make? Increased productivity? New leadership skills, restructuring and reorganizing, whatever the change, if you want to do it more quickly and more easily, contact me, Suzanne Ferguson of Suzanne Ferguson & Associates, for a free coaching session. 412-727-7299, www.sfacoaching.com.
Well, I was a little nervous first time I went into an elementary school classroom as a junior achievement volunteer. But when I saw how eager the kids were, I knew it was going to be all right. They're so thrilled you're there.
If you've ever wondered what you can do to help kids expand their horizons, find out about our new elementary school volunteer program. Call 1-800-THE-NEW-JA. That's 1-800-THE-NEW-JA. A public service message brought to you by Junior Achievement and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we have been talking to one of our favorite cookbook authors, Nancy Harmon Jenkins, whose book, Cucina del Sole, is available directly from our website, www.onthemenuradio.com. Just go to OTM Bookshelf, scroll down, click on this book, and go for it, because it's really a wonderful book. Cultural history as well as good recipes.
Yeah, and added on there just a few days ago is another wonderful book called The Sweet Spot, which is why Pichet is joining us to talk about his wonderful work.
Yeah, Pache Ong did this book on Asian-inspired desserts. And you say, by the way, Pache, that you are familiar with Nancy's work.
Yes, I am. Her book is also from the same publisher, from HarperCollins.
Very good.
I wonder if we have the same editor.
I have Harriet Bell. Who do you have?
Well, I had Susan Friedland, and then she got fired, and then I had Harriet Bell, and then she got fired.
Oh, dear.
And then I had Hugh Van Dusen.
Do you have David Sweeney now?
Hugh is the editor now.
Oh, well, there's a big turnover, I know.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
but anyhow, we're wrapping up this discussion of about Nancy's book, although she's going to stay on and talk to us about Pache. But we wanted to emphasize, didn't we, Nancy, that this food that's featured in this cuisine of the south of Italy is healthful, simple, and inspired.
Oh, and very, very easy to do. You know, it's really, I think it's the epitome of the Mediterranean diet there in the Italian south.
You both have wonderful photographers, too.
Well, thank you.
Do you know anything about Asian desserts?
Me?
Nancy, yes. I'm assuming that's Pache.
Yeah, I lived in Asia. I lived in Hong Kong for a couple of years.
You really?
Yeah. I was married to a foreign correspondent for a while, and we lived in lots of different places in the world, so Hong Kong was one of them. But I have to confess, I'm not a big sweet eater.
And no, nor am I. That's why I love it.
Yeah, so I don't get into desserts very much. But Asian desserts are interesting because they're not as sweet and as heavy as Western European desserts are.
Right. And I think in my book, it's not necessarily just on Asian desserts, but also desserts in general. The spirit is that you don't need to put that much sugar in desserts, especially if you're using seasonal fruit or using good quality ingredients or some cheeses that sometimes can accentuate the sweetness without loading it up with sugar.
Right. I think that's really important because I think sugar just kind of takes your appetite away completely.
Yeah. So the way I look at sugar is like it's a form of seasoning like salt and pepper is. If you have really good ingredients, there's no need to over-season.
Right, yeah.
Now Pache has a sort of a super impressive background, having a foreword from Jean-Georges von Gerichten, with whom he used to work quite extensively, I understand. But I have a question, Pache, because I was puzzling over this as I was looking at your book. You start out by saying most Americans have no idea what Asian desserts look like and taste like.
It is true. I think in general, I know that when I first started doing Asian desserts, or everyone was saying that Pache does Asian desserts, and a lot of journalists and the media in general were wondering what it actually is Asian dessert, because there wasn't really such a category before.
But I had another question that was leading up to. There are about 100 recipes in the book.
Yes.
How many of them are traditional Asian and how many did you invent?
Well, it first started out being 50-50, 50 traditional Asian desserts and the other 50 being general desserts that have an Asian inspiration to it in terms of ingredient or technique that I apply for, a recipe such as a cookie or a cake recipe. But I think we ended up with maybe 30% traditional Asian desserts and then about 70% American desserts with an Asian inspiration point.
And these 70 were ones you practically invented yourself?
Yes.
Now,
that's quite a guy, huh?
Yeah.
Inventing 70 new desserts.
Yeah. I think, Nancy, even though I'm not a sweets person, some of these, I'm looking at these photographs, look absolutely divine and pretty light. I mean, light on the sweet.
Yes.
Can I ask him a question?
Sure, you jump in all the time.
All right, I wanted to know, Pache, because in the Mediterranean, usually these sweet desserts are not—they're not desserts; they're sweet, but they're not served at the end of the meal. They're served at different times of the day.
Yes.
Like you might have a sweet at say 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes.
With a cup of coffee.
Yes.
Or you might even have it at 11 o'clock in the morning. But rarely would you have at the conclusion of a meal what you would have if you have anything at all would be fruit or a piece of cheese, but not a constructed sweet. And I'm wondering if that's the way sweets are served in Asia too.
That is the way sweets are served in Asia. I would say that's the way sweets are served with the rest of the world, except for America. But I think it's time that we change that, don't you think? But I think in the book I also have a lot of recipes, dessert, quote-unquote dessert recipes, that you could make and consume with your meal. Just for like, for instance, like the shaped ice,
desserts,
I think they're particularly great with spicy foods. And you get that when you go to Southeast Asia, when you go to like a hawker center where they have different dishes that they serve. It's basically street foods of Asia. And then you have like a shaved ice dessert to be consumed as a quote-unquote slash dessert beverage that you have with your meal. But a lot of it is also great that you can have throughout the day, for in the morning or in the afternoon as a snack. I think that's how desserts in general are looked at in Asia.
So it's sort of like the English having afternoon tea with little cakes.
Mm-hmm. Now this is interesting, this passion fruit dawn tot. It says it's classic dim sum.
Yes.
Originated in Portugal.
Yes, it started out in Portugal. They're basically egg custard tarts, although the Portuguese version tend to be a little bit more caramelized on top. The versions that you find in Asia are just cooked, so there's no color on the tart or on the custard itself.
Now, if I read correctly, Pichet, you now have, in fact, a restaurant that only does desserts?
Well, we actually have more than dessert. We have been labeled as a dessert bar by the media in general because I've been known to people as a pastry chef. And from a marketing standpoint, that was great for us in the beginning because it drew people in for the desserts. But we've been open for almost 2 months now. And
What's the name?
It's called Pong.
Pong. With
E asterisk O-N-G.
Yeah,
the first initial of my first name and my last name.
Right.
And people over time have discovered that I also have savory foods, including salads and raw fish and cheeses.
Really? And where is your restaurant?
We're located at 150 West 10th in Greenwich Village between 6th and 7th Avenues.
Hey, we're coming up to New York, so maybe we'll come by.
Yes, please do.
As long as I don't have to eat sweets.
No, you can eat all
them. Well, you just eat them at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
There you are, you see?
And I think I've been cursed being born with not... I have no sweet tooth at all.
Yeah, but Pichet would love your edamame ice cream and all the other ideas that
you had. Oh, yeah. Wiley Dufresne at WD-50 used to have edamame ice cream that
I adore.
Yes,
he still has that on the menu. It's fabulous.
Well, it's gone now. It's not on the menu.
Oh, no.
I just
checked
that out.
But you must have some things similar to that, I'm sure.
Do you have things like that?
Well, I have a caramel that's made with caramel sauce that's made with edamame and
really?
A little bit of yuzu juice. It's called ponzu caramel. But yes, I do have similar things, such as I have a student souffle currently on the menu that's served with arugula ice cream.
Oh, I love that thing.
Arugula ice cream.
I can see you coming around.
Oh, yeah, I'm coming around.
I can see Anne coming around to the idea of stopping by.
Spiciness to it that's great with stilton, has a sweet spiciness to it. I also have a crab salad with green apple mousse, which it's pretty traditional in terms of flavor combination where you have like apple salad with crab meat and creme fraiche. So it's deconstructed in a way that you have a mousse at the bottom and you have a crab salad on top. It's great.
You know, I should tell you about an ice cream that I had in Italy last in April when I was there. Mm-hmm. That was made. Do you know what mostarda di frutta is?
Yes.
Fruits and mustard syrup.
Mm-hmm.
This is an ice cream
that
was made from those fruits, and it was served with a local ham. This is up near Parma. It wasn't prosciutto di Parma. It was another kind of salumi, but it was a sensational combination.
Uh-huh.
Salty ham and the sweet mustardy ice cream.
I love anything from Italy. As a matter of fact, you know, we're a dessert bar, and most people think of Pong as being an Asian dessert bar, when in actuality, 70% of foods that come into the restaurant are Italian.
Ah, how funny.
Everything from olive oil to olives, cheeses, you know, so many things. I have a big cheese menu, and half of them are from Italy, including a pecorino and parmesan. Everything's great.
Okay, I'm putting that on my list when I go to New York in July.
Yeah, well, we're going to be there in July, too. Where are you going to be?
I'm going to be at the Fancy Food Show.
Me, too.
Hey,
oh, great.
Well,
look for me. I'm going to be at the Manicaretti booth.
Oh, we're always good. They're our buddies.
Oh, that's great. That's terrific.
Oh, great. Well, listen, I'm getting signals here that we need to wrap up this discussion to take another break. So let's recap here. It's Pong is where you go in Manhattan. And it's Pichet Ong, whose book you buy called The Sweet Spot. And then it's Nancy Jenkins' book, Cucina del Sole. And you buy that right off our webpage. Both books you can buy off the webpage. And any other information you want to leave with our listeners, you two?
No, just eat well and eat good food. Pay attention to the quality of your food.
That's
And eat lots of dessert. You're going to have a sweeter life, greater fortune.
Well, thank you guys so much. We're going to have to take a break now. So thank you all.
Yeah, bye, Nancy.
Welcome.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
See you in July. Bye.
Furnace working okay? How's your heating bills? You know, no kidding, an old or inefficient furnace can really add to the cost of keeping your home warm. If you want to keep costs down, get your furnace looked at, and I recommend Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning for that. The technicians at Bolster DeHart have been performing routine maintenance and installing high-efficiency heating and air conditioning systems in Pittsburgh since 1977. They're EPA-certified professionals who are continually factory-trained in all the latest installation and service techniques. They offer free estimates and don't even charge extra for Saturday service. They're a quality dealer you can trust. Stay warm this winter at the lowest possible cost. Call Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning at 412-367-3900. Maintenance or installation, Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning, 412-367-3900.
Did you know that Pennsylvania has a seatbelt law? We do, and we're enforcing it. This is Colonel Miller, Commissioner of the Pennsylvania State Police. If you are stopped and cited for speeding or any other violation, and you are not wearing your seatbelt, you are liable to get two tickets, one for speeding, one for not wearing your seatbelt. That's two tickets, two fines. When it comes to seatbelts, click it or ticket. This message brought to you by Governor Edward G. Rendell, the Pennsylvania State Police, and PennDOT.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting. Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers? Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
The flagship station of the Lifestyle Talk Radio Network. This is 1550 WLFP, Pittsburgh.
Nobody in his right mind would lie on a sheet of glass and have a steamroller crush his body. Nobody in his right mind would try to levitate from 500 feet above the Las Vegas Strip. But Chris Angel isn't in his right mind. That's what makes him the Mind Freak. Tomorrow on A&E, it's the mind-blowing hit series, Chris Angel, Mind Freak. Mind Freak! Tomorrow at 10, 9 Central, only on A&E.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Whew, I mean, life never gets dull around here. We just had two of the most interesting guests. I just love both of them.
Well, we have Ong
and Nancy Jenkins.
And we have a really fascinating guy coming up. Michael Salakis.
Psilakis.
Psilakis. There you go. Well,
get your Greek in there.
I can't. I'm only English. I can only do English.
Anyhow, he's my current heartthrob chef of the moment. I mean, in the sense of his food.
You mean I have to shave my head in order to be a heartthrob? Is that the deal?
No, I mean, you have to cook like that.
Oh, I didn't realize that was what
it's
was
It's the cooking that I'm talking about.
And Michael is just such a thoughtful guy. He philosophizes about food, but when he puts it on the plate, it tastes even better than you would think it would.
And it's Anthos is the restaurant in Manhattan, and we're going to listen to the interview we did there. Michael Psilakis is one of my most favorite chefs, and he seems to be in the business of turning around restaurants really fast. Last time we were talking, Michael, we were at Dodona, which I adored, and started telling everybody how wonderful it was, and the next thing I know, it closed. What happened, and weren't you devastated?
It was a devastating situation for us, unfortunately. What ultimately happened was we opened this restaurant in Dona, and it was critically, unbelievably successful, and the restaurant was super busy. And we had started plans on opening up a Greek restaurant, which has really been the reason why I came into Manhattan. I really wanted to showcase Greek food. It's something that, as a Greek-American, was very important to me. And as we were going through those plans, we had a visit from an Asian gentleman, Mr. Chang, and he came in one day and said, I'd like to speak to an owner. And I went up to him, and he gave me a business card and said, I'm your new landlord. And I looked down at the business card, and it said Hotelier, and didn't sit well. What ended up happening, to make a long story short, was he purchased three buildings, ours being the one in the center, and he's in the process of building a hotel. So we had a rough decision to make. He gave us the option of either staying as a restaurant during construction. He said that the construction phase of this project was going to be 5 to 7 years. Or he would buy us out of the lease. And, you know, the decision kind of made itself. There's no way that you can operate a high-end fine dining restaurant in Manhattan with the chaos of construction going on the outside for the next 5 to 7 years. So we moved our focus to the new place that we've opened on, plus the Greek restaurant that I came into the city to open ultimately. And it's been wonderful. And we've opened about 2 months now, and the reaction, the press has been favorable. And the food is really now starting to gel and come together. So it's an exciting time for Greek food and for me.
Now, Anthos means blossom. And this conceptually is what you're trying to do with the Greek food. You said you're moving it up fast. How many levels?
Well, we really, I opened up Onira two and a half, 3 years ago now, and it was a small restaurant on the west side, my first in Manhattan. And it was the first restaurant that really started to look at Greek food at the whole level, where, you know, dining was about not only experiencing food, but experiencing it on an intellectual level in terms of what we were trying to create on the plate, and then also paying attention to details and focusing on service and giving the environment that justified the food that was coming out of the kitchen. What we've done here at Anthos is we've really taken what I started at Onira and really moved it to the highest level. Anthos is a restaurant that stands on its own next to all the other great restaurants here in New York City at the Holt level. I think it's the first Greek restaurant here in New York that's really looking at food and service and dining in general at the highest possible level. It's something that we have put together, and it's something that we are focusing our energies on, really trying to expose people to Greek food and to showcase what Greek food can be.
Now, this is not the usual Greek food that people experience. As I understand it, most of the emigration were Victorian Greek, and that was an outmoded culture, actually, wasn't it?
It was. I think, you know, one of the biggest difficulties that we have with Greek food, especially the type of Greek food that we're doing here at Anthos and the type of Greek food that I generally cook, is that we're revisiting very traditional foods and we're interpreting them in a very modern way. The difficulty in that is the evolution is kind of misunderstood because we don't have enough of the traditional foods that are out there for people to really know the foundation for them to experience what the evolution is. So what we have is a whole genre of cooking here, especially in New York, where Greek food is kind of stigmatized into either two categories. You have the one category that deals with fish, specifically grilled fish, and then you have another category that focuses on the few items that people know when they talk about Greek food, moussaka, spanakopita, baklava, souvlaki, things like that. What Anthos is doing is focusing on a whole range of Greek foods. And Greece is very similar to Italy in the sense that it's very regional. So you have items in one part of Greece that they don't know or cook in other parts of Greece. And we haven't exposed them to any of those things. So what Anthos is kind of doing is it's jumping forward, and it's moving quite fast in a sense. It's almost as if there should have been a few restaurant openings in between, but we, or me specifically, wanted to really kind of bring a restaurant to New York City that was going to allow me to really take Greek food and say that it has its rightful place right next to the French and the Spaniards and the Italians here in New York dining.
Chef, this is a very modern take on, a very evolved contemporary take on Greek food. If we were to go, especially in light of having some transformation as a result of the Olympics, would we find this food or food like yours in Greece today?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think that you would find this style of food in Greece, per se. I think they've evolved tremendously from what they were a few years ago, and the Olympics did play a major role in that. It's almost as if Greece is going through a renaissance right now. You see a tremendous amount of influence from younger, second generation, younger people who are actually taking the fruits of the homeland and pushing them further. But Anthos, like Oneida, I think is one of those restaurants that's actually kind of leading the way. It's interesting when you open a restaurant and you have writers from the homeland coming to the States to actually ask you questions and to interview you and to review the restaurants that you're opening. It's a statement that I think is bold, because it's actually saying, when you think about it, that we've opened a restaurant here in the States that has captured the essence of what Greek food is in a way that the restaurants in Greece have not been able to yet. So it's one of those things that's very exciting. I think what we're going to see here is that people now ultimately are going to look at Greek food in a new way, in a new light, and that's really the whole reason why we opened this restaurant.
I'm looking at this menu. It's your dinner menu. I could start at the top and eat my way all the way through to the bottom. It's so good. Is there one dish that you could pick out of here that you could use as an example of how you evolved from the traditional to where we are?
Well, there's a couple of dishes. I think probably ones that I could use that people may know. We have a soup, a scordaglia soup. Now, scordaglia is a very traditional potato puree that's used as a garnish for fried cod. So what we've done here is we've taken the scordaglia and we've actually made a soup out of it. It's a potato soup with raw garlic and a lot of acidity in it. And what we've done is we've taken the cod aspect and we've done it in two different ways. We fry some in a light tempura and we poach some in a little bit of duck fat. And we take the ones that we poached and we make a nice fresh spring salad from that. And then we lightly, like I said, fry the second batch of cod in a tempura. And then we make a small canal of beet tartare and a little bit of creamy goat milk yogurt. And we put that onto the bottom of the plate. And then tableside, we pour the soup. So this really is just taking one of the most rustic dishes that you could have, a simple potato puree with some fried cod, or we would refer to it as bacalhados, and we've revisited it in a way that's going to bring it forward, it lightens it up, it makes it a little bit more interesting, and it's actually combined another typical dish where yogurt and beets are brought together, and we're combining two very traditional ancient dishes into one in a very modern, elegant way.
How would you describe the Greek labor profile? Because clearly you're working with this when you're updating these dishes. What is unique to a Greek profile?
Well, I think the biggest thing that you have to really understand about the menu here at Anthos is that it really strives to just capture the essence of Greek food. So what is the essence of Greek food? I think you're talking about flavor profiles. The flavor profile of Greece is one that most people really know. It's a very Mediterranean profile. It's dealing with a lot of vegetables. It's dealing very specifically with the flavors that capture the hearts of most people when you're talking about Italian food. So what's out there? You're talking olives play a major, major role in Greek food. Grapes, a lot of vegetables, tremendous amount of winter greens and wild greens, a lot of seafood, a lot of game. It's so regional, and it's very interesting because the topography of Greece changes from top to bottom. And then you have so many different islands that surround the main continent. And each one of them is interesting in their own right because of the historical migration and conquest that's occurred over time. So what you find is, you know, islands where you had Italian monks that have come in and have brought Italian things along with them. And you see the integration of these Italian items in the culinary heritage of those particular islands. There's a Corfu has a sofrito dish, which is all Italian, and actually is part of their culinary heritage. So you see this blending there. And what I've been able to do is actually take that and blend them throughout my food.
Does this guy sound like he knows what he's talking about?
Yes. And stay tuned because he's talking more. We have some more in the next segment, but we're going to take a break right now.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Join us for the Apollo moon landing celebration July 17th through the 21st, Apollo PA. 5 great days of family fun, featuring the award-winning Katanning Fireman's Band, games and rides for the kids, nightly entertainment, food. It's just good old summer fun. The Apollo Moon Landing Celebration, July 17th through the 21st at Owens Field in Apollo.
Roger. We copy you down, Eagle.
A message for older drivers from the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety.
If you find that you have to drive at night, travel in well-lighted areas when possible.
Make sure your headlights are clean.
Keep your windshield clear, both inside and out.
Avoid driving at night in the rain or other foul weather.
Also, try to avoid busy streets or other stressful situations.
It's what makes an older driver a wiser and safer driver.
For a free brochure on older driver safety, call 1-800-993-7222.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Ferguson, and I'm the owner of Suzanne Ferguson & Associates. I'm the coach that helps you get what you say you want. Are you getting what you want out of your business? Do you and your staff always reach your goals? At the end of each day, each quarter, each year, are you totally satisfied with your productivity and profitability? I'm a professional coach, and my business is completely dedicated to helping my clients make changes within their lives and business that result in increased productivity and profitability. None of us has 20/20 vision on ourselves. My clients tell me that what makes my approach unique is that I bring a fresh perspective that allows their new ideas and actions to come forth. What kinds of changes do you want to make? Increased productivity? New leadership skills, restructuring and reorganizing, whatever the change, if you want to do it more quickly and more easily, contact me, Suzanne Ferguson of Suzanne Ferguson & Associates, for a free coaching session. 412-727-7299, www.sfacoaching.com.
Welcome back. Don't forget, check out what we're doing by going to the website, www.onthemenuradio.com. You know, the whole world must know what we do.
I guess.
Yes. Well, that was Peter.
I think so.
We're going to sum up our interview. We have one more segment. I don't like to waste any words that came out of Michael Silakis's head because they're such clear, lucid kinds
of
thoughts.
Very, very thoughtful guy. But yeah. Don't lose sight of the fact that this is a very smart restaurant and the food is fabulous.
To die for. Absolutely to die for. So we'll do another brief bit on Anthos.
Shall we listen to how he concluded?
Yes.
Michael, looking over this wonderful menu, I first wanted to say that your section on meche is different. And meche in Greece is just, they're just small plates, but you are known for raw meche. Why is that?
Well, I think what I've been able to do with fish is I just look at, especially raw fish, I look at the fish itself as a platform to develop a little composition. So each one of the raw items, when you think about sashimi, rather than it just being served with wasabi and soy sauce, is a small composition onto its own. So I take, say, a piece of yellowtail or a piece of hamachi, and we're serving it right now with artichokes, which are confit and a little bit of duck fat and shaved raw, with crispy Greek grape leaves and some pickled shallot on top. And that would be one little tiny bite, all layered one on top of one another. And I think the interesting thing here is that it's one of the few times where I'm really able to force the diner to eat the entire thing at one time. And what makes it interesting for me is I'm able to control the entire experience in the palate from beginning to end. So like wine, I think about these little dishes as something having a beginning and a middle and an end. And what it allows us to do is actually create a dish that evolves as you chew. And I think it's very interesting to be able to, you know, very specifically commit the diner to eating something in its entirety and then allowing them to experiencing it exactly the way that we plan to. So these little tiny bites allow us to do that. If you come to Anthos, it would be something that you really would need to try. It's something that here in New York City I'm very known for. When people talk about me, they really talk about my raw stuff. It's something that it's my favorite medium to work in. And it's something that's just been written about so often that people really have known me for it. So that definitely would be something that I would definitely go to here. You know, it's interesting. You asked, you know, what would my meal be here at my restaurant? You know, it's so hard to say. Definitely have to have something when it comes to raw. I have two different compositions of raw here right now. One of the raws would definitely be something I would recommend starting with. It's tough to not try octopus in a Greek restaurant. I think it's kind of like the barometer of whether you know are Greek or not, almost. We have an interesting one here, but one of the other dishes that I think are great is the prosciutto rapnaragi, which is a fish that we're getting from Hawaii. It's an orange marlin, just a fantastic fish. We're wrapping it in a little bit of Greek prosciutto and searing it rare. It's served with yogurt and some really spring legumes, raw, tossed with a little bit of vinaigrette, and then we have some fresh mint there. It's just really, really fresh and really bright for this time of the year. I think it's perfect. And then I think if you go from there, probably one of my favorite dishes is the uvetzi, which is uvetzi is traditionally just a clay pot, and traditionally they would cook lamb with orzo in it. So we've taken to cooking a multitude of shellfish. We have a very interesting selection of shellfish. We use some stone crab claws. We use some whelks, some snails, some razor clams, some mahogany clams, some interesting types of mussels, some beautiful live prawns that we get in from Hawaii. So it's a really interesting mixture of shellfish. And we do, it's cooked in a really enriched fish stock. We take halibut bones and we roast them in the oven, and we make this really super rich fish stock from it. And then when we're plating the dish, we render out a little bit of Margaise sausage to get a little spice in there, and we add the shellfish individually to quantify the cooking time on each one, and then we add the stock, and it all comes together with the orzo, so you get this really spicy shellfish kind of thing. It's a wonderful dish.
Well, you have me hungry. Where are we exactly? Could you give us the location?
We have, the name of the restaurant is Anthos. We're in Manhattan, New York. The exact address is 36 West 52nd Street. Our telephone number is 212-582-6900. And our website should be up in a couple of weeks, is www.anthos, which is ANTHOSNYC.com.
Well,
we hadn't even eaten yet at that point, had we?
I know, but I mean,
talk about singing for your supper.
Yeah, the other place to go is for crudo. The raw stuff is Esca. I mean, that
it would
David
be hard Pasternak. To pick the two. And there was another place we went where we really had excellent.
Where was that?
It was Avocado.
Oh, we did.
Which is also Greek owned.
Greek owned, right?
So you got.
Got lots of
a number of choices, all absolutely excellent. I did feel I was about to be manipulated because I knew I was going to have to eat my fish in one bite.
you know what? When he was talking about all that, why aren't razor clams more widely used? I think they're wonderful.
Yeah, we had wonderful ones in England too. I think.
Yeah.
Perhaps they're just not readily available. I really don't know.
They sort of litter all the beaches. I mean, I think they were not valued because they were so.
They look a little odd. Out of the shell, they look like something you might not eat unless you really knew they tasted good.
Yeah.
because they're sort of odd sort of configuration.
Yeah.
It's really not very much like a clam.
You know, I think that we're way overdue to run this next track.
Well, we are.
When it was such a wonderful event that Taste of the Nations Share Our Strength, and we caught up with our good buddy Floyd Cardos of Tabla in New York City, who's the Share Our Strength Humanitarian of the Year, and just had a quick chat with him before the festivities got underway.
Yeah, and in case we forget afterwards, there will be a Share Our Strength event again in 2008, and it's going to be probably around about May. We'll be letting people know about it on the show, but it's an event that shouldn't be missed because the cooking was extraordinary, and I'm sure they'll have a special guest like Floyd next year too.
True. Let's listen.
Now, we promised, and here we are, on the menu is that Taste of the Nation with Floyd Cardos, who's the guest chef in Pittsburgh for the Share Our Strength event. Share Our Strength's Humanitarian of the Year is Floyd Cardos, and he's actually cooking at this event. Welcome to Pittsburgh, Floyd.
Thank you, Anderson. I'm so happy to be here.
Tell us what you're cooking, because we're going to, I can smell it. Go ahead.
I'm going to be making something which is very, very dear to my heart. It's actually combining two dishes. One is called a shrimp bachao, which is a shrimp dish that is made in India, in Goa, from the state that I come from, in the monsoon season, when it's actually made before the monsoon season. Because once the monsoon season comes in, there's no seafood available, and we Goans love seafood. So it's basically almost like a shrimp cocktail, if you will, but it's pickled. And it's got chilies and ginger and garlic and cumin and cinnamon and clove and mustard, and in India we use a little bit of a local brew, but I'm using tequila over here. So it's a sweet, sour, spicy, jump in your mouth kind of dish, and it's going to be served with a cucumber and coconut raita.
It smells absolutely heavenly, and thank you so much for coming here.
I'm so happy to be here, and thank you for having me on your show again.
And we'll keep having you on our show, because we love you.
Thank you.
And it did taste good.
It did taste good.
I had several portions.
Yes.
Where several is not one, two, three, or four.
Yeah.
And I was reading the 10 best new chefs from Food & Wine magazine. Now that they've been on the cover of the magazine, we're facing a big challenge because they have to cook just one dish, one very special dish to prove their worth for, 1,000 people, which is
When do they do that?
At the Aspen.
Oh, is it the Aspen Food and Wine Festival?
Yeah. Okay. Which we're not going to go to. So.
No.
Anyhow, we also have...
Are we snobs or are they snobs?
I'm not sure.
I think they're snobs, so we decided we'd be snobs right back and we wouldn't go.
Okay. Well, at any rate, we have another event.
Well, we're going to go back. We're going to go back to the Beard Awards.
We almost lost one interview from the Beard Awards, and I think it's important to do it because this chef drew a whole press corps from Japan because he was a finalist.
I was lucky to be able to grab him away from the Japanese broadcasters who surrounded him. I did the interview, so you can be sure that I asked a couple of the wrong questions, but let's see how I did.
Nobuo Fukuda from Seesaw Restaurant in Scottsdale, Arizona, won Best Chef Southwest. And the first question I wanted to ask you, Nobuo, is how does that feel?
I feel very blank. I don't have anything in my mind. It's like so wide out.
And I understand your mother is in Japan, and I'm sure you're going to call her. What do you think she'll say?
She'll probably say, well, that's good. I don't think she's too much know what's going on.
But did she get you started with your interest in food and cooking?
Actually, other way around, my mom was working, and my father was retired, staying home. She cooked for us. His food is awful. So whenever we like to eat good with me and my sister, we have to cook ourselves. That's how we interest in cooking.
I sometimes say that about my mother. Her cooking was awful. No, but tell us a little bit about your restaurant in Scottsdale.
Our restaurant is called Seesaw. It's very small, 26 seating, around the counters. That's our kitchen, and that's what your dining room. And we cook from fish, vegetable, mostly organic local grow, and Japanese fish mostly from Japan, little bit of meat, and pair with wine. In small dishes, in the wines, we do have about 3,000 kind. So we are wine-oriented tapas bar. That's kind of what it is.
Is there a sushi bar everybody closes up to?
I don't have any sushi. We do all the small plates of either steam, deep fry, grill, or some of them just sear raw fish, maybe. But that's all, no sushi roll or no rice involved. Just a small bite for your wine to drink.
Well, once again, congratulations, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you very much again.
You know, I think we're running out of time. I think we just timed it perfectly.
So this is good.
Yeah, it was perfect timing then.
Amazing, amazing.
Amazing.
What a duo.
Oh, yes.
A dynamic duo.
Yes, and again, next time.
Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.
Don't forget Chef Fukuda and Seesaw in Phoenix, Arizona, Scottsdale, Arizona. We're certainly going to go there just to find out what it's like.
Bye-bye.
Jazzin' Around with David J is next on The Edge, AM 1550.
It all happened so fast. It was loud and scary, and I was trapped.
Katie is a kindergarten teacher in Pennsylvania. She was a passenger in a car struck head-on by a reckless driver.
That's when I met my guardian angel. His name is Sean, and he's a paramedic. Sean was there for me when I needed him. He knew just what to do, and he knew the right things to say.
Choose a career in emergency medical services. Call toll-free 877-PA-MEDIC. That's 877-PA-MEDIC.
Pennsylvania needs more guardian angels. I had mine, and he made all the difference.
I know I need to pay attention to my health, but I just can't seem to find the time. Between rushing to work and taking care of the kids, there's not much time left over for me. So I decided to start small by eating more fruits and vegetables and being more active. And then I got the family to make some changes too. We started by keeping a bowl of fresh fruit on the counter, and I limit the amount of sweet snacks I keep in the house. I've also found some creative ways to add more vegetables to our meals. We're taking more walks, and on the weekends, we head down to the pool at the rec center. It doesn't happen every day, but it does happen. You don't have to change your entire life to be healthier. Just make some simple changes and include your family. You'll see how easy and fun it can be.
You can make a difference. Eat smart, play hard. And when you do, your kids will too. A challenge from USDA.